You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
The final breakout session. Only the most spiritual would stick around this long. So thank you for coming. All right, my subject here this evening, this afternoon, I guess, People Skills 101. Kind of ironic that I'm teaching a class on this. I think it's kind of funny. But sometimes it's those of us who have learned the most, who it didn't come naturally for, that might be able to help other people. So why are we doing a People Skills workshop when the title of the conference is How Will They Hear? This is an evangelism conference. Well, here's the thing. You guys probably know this. We share Christ in the context of relationships. It's not a pure informational download, okay? We don't just give them a text, a comma-separated text file that has all the information they need to receive Jesus Christ. And relationships require people skills. You know, it's in the context of friendships. If we have a come-off that just makes people feel strange and they try to avoid us, that's going to hurt our ability to share the love of Christ with them. It's going to hurt our ability to love people, which is at the heart of what we're trying to accomplish here. So we want to talk about people skills. It's a little bit hard to define. What are people skills? How do you define them? Are people skills something that you can improve in? Is it like IQ, where you just are sort of born with a certain amount of it? Or is this an area where we can grow? And if you can improve, how do you improve in people skills? This is an area, there's a whole field of research devoted to what secular researchers call emotional intelligence. And what some biblical people from a biblical perspective have kind of built upon that, those findings, with what they call relational wisdom. And I've done a decent amount of reading and study in this area over the past year and a half, 2 years. And I wanted to share with you guys some of what I've learned. And this, I'm speaking here as someone who this did not come very supernaturally for me. I'm a kind of guy that was kind of awkward. I was kind of a little bit of an outsider, didn't pick up on social cues, didn't really quite know how to mesh with people. These are things that I've kind of had to learn the hard way, and things I wish I would have known. I had to learn. And I've also helped awkward people. Not that any of you are awkward people, but if I can help them, surely, you know, how much more you guys? Emotional intelligence, what is it? The concept was popularized by Daniel Goleman's 1995 book, Emotional Intelligence, Why It Can Matter More Than IQ. This book and others like it, they explore the question, why is it that the most successful people are not necessarily the smartest? You know, the smartest are often viewed as nerds, right? And they kind of don't fit in. The best looking, not necessarily the strongest. What is it that people have that leads to success, that leads to popularity? And the answer is those people often have strong people skills, which is really, it's not related to IQ, and yet is a strong predictor of success. Goleman writes, we have all known people with an annoying lack of social graces. People who don't seem to know when to end a conversation or a phone call. They keep on talking, oblivious to all cues and hints to say goodbye. People whose conversation centers on themselves all the time without the least interest in anyone else. Who ignore tentative attempts to refocus on another topic. People who intrude or ask nosy or inappropriate questions. You guys know anybody like this? If you're a meta person like this? Yeah? Okay. You know, they've studied popular versus unpopular kids. This is often what makes the difference between the popular kids and the unpopular kids. Goleman points out that people, you know, popularity in third grade is the strongest predictor of mental health issues at age 18, more than any other factor. They say people who lack EI are just, quote, off. The kids are just off in ways that you can't quite explain why they can't seem to gel with other people, but it does lead to an avoidance or rejection, which then, you know, valuable social skills that you should be learning, if people are just kind of avoiding you, it hinders your chance to learn those. And so the rich get richer and the others, they don't, okay? They point out again and again in the literature how growth in your emotional intelligence or your EQ, they're all kind of basically used interchangeably, people skills, EI, EQ. This can impact every area of your life. They show just correlation in just about every area. These guys point out, in another book that I'll quote from, they point out every point increase in your EQ adds $1,300 to your annual salary. And so it just shows how success in your job, which is really success in working with people, it's not about necessarily how smart you are, but it's how well do you work with people. You know, you think about, I have an Android phone, right? And as long as the Android operating system is working properly, I can install all kinds of different apps on there. I got my maps off, I got my map, I got my, you know, calculator, I got my timers, I got my shopping apps, I got all kinds of apps, right? But if the OS is busted, then none of the apps are gonna run properly. And your emotional intelligence, relational wisdom, it's kind of like an operating system for life. If your operating system is running properly, you can install the evangelism app, and that's going to work real well. Also, the marriage app is going to run a lot more smoothly. The parenting app is going to just go so much better. You know, the relationship app, the ministry app, the leadership app, all these different apps are going to run so much better as long as you have this base of people skills, of emotional intelligence, of relational wisdom. And, you know, as Bible-believing Christians, we shouldn't be surprised by this because Scripture says we're designed for relationships. We shouldn't be surprised that successful relational skills lead to success in all these other areas of life. God says it is not good for the man to be alone. Genesis 2:18, Jesus says the greatest commandment, love God, love one another, designed for love. 1 John 4:7, God is love. Let us love one another. Love is from God. Everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. God has this impact. The fruit of the Spirit is love, it says in Galatians. And even though emotional intelligence is not a biblical term, the Bible talks a lot about relationships and wisdom. And it says things about wisdom like this. The beginning of wisdom is this. Get wisdom. That's the starting point. Though it cost all you have, get understanding, cherish her, and she will exalt you. And so we've got to have a hunger, a humility. I need wisdom. There's an intentionality. This is not for the passive. We're going to have to be students of wisdom. Some of us maybe have a longer way to go than others, but we all can constantly be improving in wisdom, improving in our relational wisdom, our ability to relate to other people. Paul says this is important for our evangelism too. Conduct yourselves with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of every opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace as though seasoned with salt, so you'll know how you should respond to each person. And so we're gonna need wisdom. We're gonna need to know when is the right time to bring up this question, when is the right time not to. How is it that I earn someone's trust? How is it that I build a relationship? And so we need, you know, and you think about salt. You know, salt, you add it to the same food, and all of a sudden the food is tasty. The food is good. Without salt, it's just kind of bland. You don't really want it. And relational wisdom can have that effect. There's a winsomeness that we will have if we possess these qualities. And there's a spiritual power that we will have. In their book, Emotional Intelligence 2.0, Bradbury and Greaves, they break it down into four core areas, four core competencies. They call them self-awareness and self-management. So there's two that relate to self. And then there's two that relate to others. Social awareness, it's the counterpart to self-awareness, right? And relationship management or relational engagement. And then they've got all kinds of others that sort of are built upon these. But these are kind of the core. And all the others flow from that. As Christians, we would add two more to upgrade this concept to relational wisdom. We would add God awareness and God engagement because we're not just existing in this plane here. And this is the folks at RW360, this is sort of their tagline, going beyond emotional intelligence. It's not instead of, we as Christians, we believe in science, right? We believe in the results of studies of how people work, what makes people tick. But it's not enough. We need to go beyond that. We need to add in the rest of the picture. And so this is why they have, you know, the self dimension, the others dimension, but a third direction. And so this is their 360. It's sort of, there's three directions, self, others, and God. And so all three need to be kind of worked in here. And, you know, this is why some Christians, they're a little bit suspicious. You know, there's a book like honestly, Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, classic from early 20th century. This book is, you know, some Christians read it and they're like, this book's amazing. I need this. My disciple really needs this. And others are like, I don't know. That sounds kind of like worldly wisdom and manipulation. And yeah, you know, it depends on who you are, how you use the tools. You know, Hitler would probably use that information one way. Billy Graham would probably use it another way. So we're anchored in our relationship with God and our biblical values, and he is ultimately the one who we're trying to please. But so I'll really talk more on the top four here, but then I'll kind of sprinkle in how our biblical worldview affects how we view and how we put into practice these things. So first one is self-awareness. They write, people high in self-awareness are remarkably clear in their understanding of what they do well, what motivates and satisfies them, which people and situations push their buttons. So they have a sober view of self, which is, this is like straight out of Romans chapter 12, verse 3. Don't think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment in accordance with the faith God has distributed to each of you. And so, you know, this is where my view of myself is filtered through what God says. This is in accordance with the faith. But we need to have an accurate, not too high, not too low. You ever play basketball with somebody that thinks they can shoot, but they can't? Not a real good teammate. You don't want to be on their team. You know, they should, you know, they need to know what they do well to, you know, maybe they should be there rebounding, right? Maybe they're like a rebounding machine. Let's have them do that, contribute to the team, and then we can work together a lot better. So we need to have self-awareness. One key area, they point out 83% of people who are high in self-awareness ranked as top performers in their jobs. So they've done a lot of study in the business world because it's, you know, the question is, should businesses invest in training and emotional intelligence for their people? And they point out, for every dollar invested, usually the payback is somewhere between $1.50 and almost $7 in profit for businesses. And so more and more businesses are doing this. And actually, RW360, they also train people on how to go into businesses, do training, and then say, we do have a faith-based version of this training if you're interested. And they've actually seen, you know, people come to Christ that way. It's because they kind of get them with, these are biblical values, and then they see the biblical values underlying that. But 83% of people high in self-awareness are top performers. Just 2% of bottom performers are high in self-awareness. So if you can increase your self-awareness, you're going to increase, like I've said, you'll see benefits in every area of your life. When we talk about emotions, what does the Bible say about emotions? An emotional awareness. God is an emotional God. This is not like the Force in Star Wars, right? This is, you know, when Moses says, God, what do you like? He says, compassionate, gracious, loving kindness, anger. So he's listing emotions or ways that he is. And we're made in his image. So we are emotional beings. We have feelings, whether or not we like it or not. You can't get around these feelings. These emotions, they involve our whole being. If you get angry, I've learned to notice my breathing is speeding up. My jaw is clenching. My fists are clenching. I'm like, okay, I'm in the danger zone here. I might do something stupid. Goleman points out fear. So fear has a certain physiological reaction, impact on your body. He says, when people who fear snakes are shown pictures of snakes, sensors on their skin will detect sweat breaking out, which is a sign of anxiety, even though they say they do not feel any fear. And so long before they're aware that they're feeling anxiety or fear, their body has already started responding. Their body is already producing sweat. And so, you know, the sensors can detect your emotion before your brain can detect your emotions sometimes. In fact, they say the sweat shows up in such people even when the picture of a snake is presented so rapidly, they have no conscious idea of what they just saw, let alone that they're beginning to get anxious. So if you flash a snake so quickly they can't even tell what they just saw, part of their brain knows what it is and starts the fear, starts the anxious response going. Yeah. Emotions then move us to act. So we might have emotions happening that we're not even aware of them, but they're driving us to act. You know, sometimes in bad ways. Joseph's brothers, so envious in Genesis 37 that they sell him into slavery. Sometimes in good ways. Pharaoh's daughter, filled with compassion at this little baby she just found floating in the Nile. She wants to adopt this baby. And that's why Moses grew up in Pharaoh's palace. You think about a sailboat. If you know how to sail, I'm not a sailor. But if you know how to sail, it's just you just see these guys out there just flying across the lake. So beautiful. But if you don't know how to sail, that wind catches the sail the wrong way, that boat can be tipped over in no time. And you're out there in the lake and you've had a disaster and you're treading water and your boat is wrong side down. And you're not sure how to get it back up. And sometimes this happens in our relational lives because the emotions grab us, they catch us the wrong way, and before we know it, the boat is tipped, there's another disaster, and there I am treading water again, not sure how I'm going to fix this mess. Emotions are not inherently sinful. Some people are suspicious of all emotions. They must be bad if it's a feeling. Jesus had so many feelings when he was here. Compassion, anger, tears, love. But they're often twisted by sin. You know, like Cain, so angry he kills Abel. You know, our proud hearts are offended. The heart is desperately wicked, Jeremiah says. Who can understand it? And so it's not that all emotions are terrible, but they are warped by the fall. Quick neuroscience here. I actually spent a whole breakout session last year talking about this. And so there's some things I'm going to skip or briefly mention. When information comes to your brain, it comes up the spinal cord to this place called the thalamus. That's like the hub for the brain. And then that sends information to a number of places, but the two we're worried about here. One is the amygdala, which processes emotions. The other, the neocortex, which is rational thought. Do you notice which one's closer to the thalamus? The emotions. The information gets there quick, and a lot of times what happens is the amygdala slams on the alarm, warning, you know, which is useful if you're actually being attacked in primitive times. A lot of the things we fear are not life-threatening anymore. And so this is what the literature calls, and they've actually done functional MRIs, and they see just this part of the brain light up with blood flow when a strong emotion is being felt. And you know where there's not blood flow? That front part of the brain. This is called amygdala hijacking. I like the image of hijacking because it's almost like an imposter has broken in and taken the controls of the airplane and is flying it where it should not go. And this is why we have the, when you have overwhelming emotions, you have the fight or flight response where I can't think, but I'm shut down. I can't think, but I'm raging. What they say is if you can just, something as simple as awareness of that emotion, naming that emotion is enough to bring online this part of the brain, and they see this part of the brain light up, and that's enough to kind of tamp down the crazy, out of control hijack that's happening. And I talk about that and a whole lot of other stuff in my breakout session from last year. But this is some of the neuroscience behind emotions and the effect they can have on us. Emotions very important for relationships. Rejoicing with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep. If we cannot process emotions, then we're going to have a hard time in our relationships. If you're trying to relate to a person who's completely emotionally closed off, it's not a great experience. Unfortunately, a lot of times we get into marriage and our emotional intelligence is very low and it creates problems in our marriage. We're going to have to learn that the hard way. Better to learn it before you're married as much as possible. You probably still have some learning to do there, though. When you don't take time out to notice and understand your emotions, they have a strange way of resurfacing when you least expect or want them to. It's their way of trying to bring something important to your attention. And they go on to say, the emotions will persist and the damage will mount until you notice. Some of the literature gives the example of anger. You know, you have an interaction earlier in the day that just makes you angry, but you don't realize you're angry. And so you're being short, you're being very like, kind of surly with people for several hours after that, you have no idea. It's obvious to everybody else. This is where low self-awareness is keeping you from interacting with people in a loving way, and it's hurting your relationships. Simply being aware that I have anger and then taking strategies to deal with that anger can then put me back in a place where I'm back and I can actually make choices that I want to make in my relationships. Fortunately, just thinking about it, simple awareness goes a long way when it comes to emotional self-control and things like that. So that's self-awareness. Self-management is closely related to that. I'm not going to say too much about this just because there's so much that I could say about all this, and we've only got an hour. We do need positive strategies for dealing with our feelings, though. Some of us, we get stressed out, and we've got all these negative ways of dealing with it, like shopping or pornography or eating or raging or just checking out and just zoning out and binging Netflix. We need positive strategies. If you want more on this, my last year breakout from last year, also Ken Sandy's plenary from last year goes into some more of this stuff. introducing the subject. And I'll have a number of resources at the end of this as well, if you guys want to do further reading, either shorter stuff or longer stuff. But I want to show a short clip of The Office here. Okay, so what's great about The Office is you have Dwight and Michael Scott, right, who are very low on emotional intelligence, low awareness, low on people skills. And then you have people who are high awareness, higher on people skills, like Jim and Pam. And part of what's so funny about this show is you have the clueless people interacting with the people who aren't. This research has just brought into focus, okay, this is The Office in a nutshell. So here's just a 1 minute clip and then we'll briefly discuss it.
Nice. All done. What's wrong, Michael?
I got gum in my hair.
You do?
This just stinks. Don't touch it. Please don't touch it.
You got a ton of dandruff.
Okay, let me be.
How'd you get gum in your hair?
I was walking in and I noticed something shiny under Stanley's car and I got under to see what it was and I messed up my hair. All for a stupid piece of tinfoil.
But best case scenario, you thought it was a quarter.
Kill me. Right now.
We have peanut butter in the kitchen.
I don't feel like peanut butter. Give me an ice cream sandwich.
Nope, not for you. It's for your hair. And it is 9 a.m.
No, Dwight, not the good peanut butter. People are going to get mad.
Hey. This is my hair we're talking about. Smells good.
Tastes good, too.
Oh, Donald, that's disgusting.
Wow, a lot of calories.
Well, just don't leave it on too long. Keep massaging, please.
All right, what are some low emotional intelligence points you can notice here from Michael or Dwight? Yeah, Jesse.
Obviously, the two at the beginning are having like an interaction with each other, and he just
totally interrupted it, just slams down there. Good. Yeah. Yes, he didn't understand it, didn't listen to it, thought he knew best. He's like, I'm not hungry for peanut butter. And they're like, it's for your hair. Yeah.
His like emotions got so extreme that he was like, just kill me.
Yeah, I know. Flops down. It's obvious something's wrong. He's completely out of control, completely hijacked. Just kill me. Pity party, anger. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. He's like, yeah, you got a lot of dandruff in there. And he's licking the peanut butter off his head. Yeah, Jenny. Yes, he totally. Running, yes. So intense. It's like, dude, chill out, okay? This is way overkill. Whereas Jim and Pam, what'd you notice from them? Yeah. Okay, she stops her conversation. She's got the awareness. She's like, what's wrong, Michael? Good. Yeah. Okay, so she's got a solution. She knows where it is. It's just proactive here. Good. Yeah, so they're asking questions. Maybe they could be a little nicer about it, but it's really funny the way it goes like that. Yeah, good. So, okay, so that's a short little intermission. All right, so that was self-awareness, important. Let's talk about social awareness, all right? Something that Michael and Dwight really lack. It's your ability to accurately pick up on emotions in other people and understand what is really going on with them. Listening and observing are the most important elements of social awareness. To listen well and observe what's going on around us, we have to stop doing many things we like to do. Like, we have to stop talking. We have to stop the monologue that may be running through our minds. And we'll post all these PowerPoints as well. It might already be posted, honestly, from yesterday. Stop the monologue running through our minds. Stop anticipating the point the other person's about to make. Stop thinking ahead to what we are going to say next. It takes practice to really watch people as you interact with them and get a good sense of what they're thinking and feeling. And at times, you'll feel like an anthropologist. You know, they go out into the wild, they get their binoculars out, and from, 1,000 yards away, they're observing the way the chimpanzees interact with one another. only problem is you're not 1,000 yards away with binoculars. You're right there in the middle of the interaction. You've got to have control of your own emotions so you're not totally like hijacked yourself and losing it yourself. You've got to have enough self-awareness and self-control that you can interact in a positive way and also observe what's going on with other people in this situation. You think about poker players, right? You got to know poker strategy. You got to study the cards. But you also have to have very high others awareness. Awareness of how many chips the other people have. Poker players have to be very carefully studying, is my opponent acting slightly differently in ways that show that they have confidence in this hand? Are they bluffing? And so very high social awareness is needed for poker players. This is something that I just didn't know you had to do, right? Monitor yourself and monitor others. So I found myself in one-on-one meetings with people, sometimes in meetings with groups, where I have to be like, okay, I'm getting angry. I'm feeling anxious. And I have to get that under control enough that I can also notice, okay, there's times where I'm in meetings and I'm tracking what's going on, but I'll just kind of briefly look around the room and I'll think to myself, so what is this person feeling right now? What might this person be feeling right now? One-on-one conversations trying to be like, so what are they feeling right now? And what would be appropriate to say or to not say in this moment? And that was just a way that I did not think in those terms until I started doing some of the study over the past few years. And I wonder how many of us really think in those ways. But practice can become more natural, but you're gonna have to be intentional about it at first. And there'll probably be always some element of intentionality. Empathy is an important part here. You know, self-awareness of our emotions, but empathy is trying to understand the other person's perspective and their emotional state. There's two kinds of empathy. One's called cognitive empathy. This is where I intentionally try to view things from the perspective of another person. The other is called affective empathy. This is where I actually feel what the other person is feeling. And God has actually wired us for empathy. What they've shown is that they've kind of hooked up sensors to people's brains, and they've noticed that when you see someone feeling something, those parts of your brain start to light up. They're called mirror neurons. And so we're broken, obviously, but that's part of our design. And so the feeling what the other person is feeling, that's a little bit harder. That just sort of happens. But you can intentionally try to see things from their perspective. And sometimes just seeing things from their perspective is enough to start to light up the feeling sensors as well. And so you start to feel what they're feeling. And you are going to be able to interact with them in a much more constructive way once you empathize with them. This is the problem a lot of times in marriage. A lot of conflicts, the person does not feel heard or understood, whether it's marriage or otherwise. God is an empathetic God. How surprising to find that God, the least, you know, we're such insignificant little beings compared to him. Why does he care what we're thinking or how we feel? And yet he does. Jesus had compassion on the crowds because they were confused and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Jesus sobs on the way into Jerusalem because he sees ahead to the siege of Jerusalem. He sees they're going to kill your babies and rape the women and cart people off into slavery and tear this place. He knows the pain they're going to go through, and he weeps decades in advance just because he sees and he wishes they would have listened. When Moses says to God, what do you like? He says, Yahweh, Yahweh God. And what's the first quality? Compassionate. I was always a little surprised by that. I would have put love first or gracious. But no, he puts compassion at first. Compassion is even beyond empathy. He gets in touch with what we're feeling. He feels pity. It moves him to act in ways to help this pitiful person who's in this horrible state. And of course, Jesus taking on flesh. Talk about the ultimate sympathy. We do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses. So he knows how it feels. He knows what it's like. He's been there. You know, he's had like the first person camera angle here of our life with all the feelings that come with it. And so God sympathizes with us. Goleman says, failure to register another's feelings is a major deficit in emotional intelligence and a tragic failing in what it means to be human. That sounds like a biblical theologian writing that. The atheist has no room to say something like that. But the Christian does. This flows right from our worldview. I love it when scientists find things that just confirm what the Bible has been saying all along. Some of us were emotionally tone deaf, and guys, we tend to be a little worse at it than women. From an early age, actually, boys' emotions are treated differently than girls' emotions. And so women are more sensitive to a sad expression on a man's face than men are in detecting that sad expression on the woman's face. And unfortunately, what it means is a woman has to be all the sadder for the man to notice her feelings in the first place, let alone for him to raise the question of what's making her so sad, which is probably not what he wants to do. One of the things they were saying in these books is one of the strategies for helping distressed marriages is not to get in there and talk about the fight you had about finances or family or whatever, but it's just to try to help both people in the marriage increase their emotional intelligence. And then that, as that rising tide, it will kind of help all the conflicts and get the boats unstuck from the ocean floor. We're going to have to learn to read nonverbal signals. I've got a little exercise for this. All right. So this is the original. This is the handout you guys have. The original test, this was from Harvard, 1979. PONS stands for Profile of Nonverbal Sensitivity. The original was 220 questions. I just clipped 12 questions here from the short version of the test. What you're going to see is you're going to see a one-second clip of either a woman's face, a woman's, like, from the neck down, body language, or you're going to hear her words, but they garble the words. So you can't know what the words are, but you can hear the tone and the speed of the words. And for each one of these, you're going to answer, is it A or B? All right, and then I'll give you the answer key. And the one I taught yesterday, two people in the whole main campus auditorium got all 12 right. So we'll see how good you guys are. Ready? This is about a minute and a half, 2 minutes here. All right, you ready for the answers here? Why don't you grade your test there, grade your quiz. All right, how many people got at least 6 right? Yeah? Okay, good. Answering randomly would have gotten that, I guess, right? How many got at least 9 right? Okay. Anybody get all 12 right? Nobody. Whoa, okay. It's kind of hard. For several of those, you kind of knew what it was, but you couldn't quite articulate it, maybe. Maybe you could if you had time to think about it, but they said that people who are higher in reading people, as the 220 question test went along, they got better and better as the test went along. It's almost like you're working muscles intentionally you don't necessarily normally work. Empathy, really important in conflict. Really important in conflict. Can you see the conflict from the other person's perspective? Do you think they're just a complete idiot for the way they're acting and the position they're taking in this? You might not be in a position to resolve this conflict yet. They might be able to tell you think they're a complete idiot. And that's not great for, like, harmony and resolution. And sometimes they don't even want their way. They just want to be heard. They want to be understood. And so it is important in conflict. We're going to have to get our own emotions under control in order to tune in to what they're feeling. Because we might be so angry that they're not empathizing with us. But Jesus said, do unto others as you want them to do unto you. And so we need to practice the golden rule, and sometimes we'll end up getting the golden result, which is we do unto others, and then they do what we want them to do unto us, but only because we did it first. We initiated. A few other tips on empathy. One advantage we have as Christians is we can ask God right in the middle of a conversation, God, what are they feeling right now? God, what do I need to notice here? That's a question you can ask in a meeting with someone, in a meeting with a group of people, in a tense conflict. You can also ask the person. You don't have to guess at this. You can ask how they're feeling and then listen to what they say. I think it's also, one thing I've found is being present for important moments, you know, being there for the funeral, the wedding. It's costly to go. Some of these weddings, they're further and further away. Going to the hospital, going to visit someone when they're sick. Scripture talks about that. And it's one thing to hear this person, you know, fell and now they're in the hospital. They had a seizure. But then it's quite another thing when you actually go to, you're like, okay, then you go to the hospital and all of a sudden you're checking in. And then you're getting in the elevator and you're seeing sick people and you're walking into the room and you see the scared look on their face. And you just, when you're there with them, it just hits different. And you can feel what they're feeling. And so there's just a being present with people that sometimes is what's needed for empathy. All right, let's also talk about listening. Listening. God is a God who listens to us. He empathizes, he's compassionate, and he listens to us. It says, we know that he hears us, 1 John 5. He sees us. God looks at the outside. Man looks at the outside. The Lord looks at the heart. Genesis 16, his name is the God who sees, El Roy. We, on the other hand, have serious hearing problems. When it comes to God, for example, Jesus says, whoever has ears to hear, let him hear. But also with other people. James has some pretty good advice. My dear brothers and sisters, take note of this. He's really emphasizing this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. We got to shut up. We got to listen. All right, that anger keeps us from hearing. We got to deal with our anger so that we are in our right mind so we can hear what the other person's saying. I love Proverbs 18:13. To answer before listening, that is folly and shame. And you will be embarrassed if you answer before listening, if you just start talking. Proverbs says, even the fool, if he shuts up, he looks wise. And, you know, we'll probably become wiser just by shutting up and listening, trying to read the situation, trying to hear what's really being said. A couple of tips on this. One, stop multitasking while listening. The truth is, we can't multitask. What studies have shown is what we think is multitasking, a better term for it is switch tasking. We're switching between two things up as fast as we can, back, forth, back and forth. This is partly why we're so exhausted in our modern digital age. It's because our brains are constantly switching and our attention is fractured. And that's why we feel tireder than, you know, people in other cultures that had less stuff filling their brains and less things distracting them. And so when you're on the phone with somebody, can you just not, sometimes don't try to do something else also at the same time. And I'm, you know, guilty. Can you put the phone in do not disturb mode for that meeting you're having with this person so you're not constantly, and your watch, smartwatch is binging. I've got the notifications turned off on my smartwatch, okay? So just a watch, right? For exercise, I guess. Can we, like, there's times at meetings where instead of having the laptop open like this, I'll just kind of shut it almost the whole way. And that makes a statement. I'm listening here. I'm tuning in here instead of just on the laptop during the meeting, looking up occasionally. The other one is we need to practice active listening. When you listen, you don't listen with just your ears, but you're listening with your whole body. And you're also sending signals that I'm listening. You know, think about it. You know, listening like this, looking away versus leaning forward, looking at the person, nodding, even occasionally saying, mm-hmm, things like that, making little noises and make it sound like you're listening. You might ask a follow-up question and then you be quiet and you listen. You're not jumping in and giving advice and telling my thing or criticizing them. You're just listening and you're making sure you hear what they're saying before you're jumping in with what you might feel led to say. This is also a good time to pray. Lord, help me to hear. And you're hearing with your eyes as well. You're looking at body language and trying to read the situation. I'm not going to do this exercise now, but one that's the little link here, I'll have it at the end. It'll be in the online. Great talk from Lee Campbell, one of our counselors here, on listening. It's a whole workshop. It actually would be a great 1 or 2 week cell group study. But one of the exercises he has is an active listening exercise. He says, take 2 minutes with a partner, talk about something going on in your life. The partner needs to not talk. And I've talked to several people who are like, it was so hard to not talk for 2 minutes. And then you're practicing active listening, and then you try to summarize what you heard, maybe ask a follow-up question, listen a little more, validate. I can see why you're feeling this way because of this. And you're trying to summarize. This is an exercise in marriage as well, where the one spouse needs to just listen to the other one and then repeat back to them in your own words, what are they saying and how are they feeling? And make sure that they were understood. So that's one you can do. But I honestly, I recommend that whole workshop. It's great. All right. Finally, moving along here to relationship management. So we've had self-awareness, self-management, social awareness, and then relationship management. This is the ability to, it taps into the other three skills. You'll need self-awareness. You'll need the self-control. You'll need social awareness in order to engage fruitfully with other people. But it's your ability to use your awareness of your own emotions and those of others to manage interactions successfully. Goleman says, this is, I thought, really interesting. They've done a lot of research on children, trying to observe kids, because a lot of this stuff shows up pretty early in life. And sometimes if you can get to it early, you can really, the kid will benefit from that as they go through school age. But they find children who show signs of social deficiency, children whose awkwardness makes them neglected or rejected by their playmates. Kids who are off, they call it. Social ineptitude is perhaps most painful and explicit when it comes to one of the more perilous moments in the life of a young child. You ready for it? The moment when the child is standing on the edge of the group that's playing and they want to join the group. Do you remember this as a child? This happens at our home churches as well, doesn't it? You got to join a group of people. You got to walk into a room with people. More and more people today have social anxiety. They can't be around groups. They don't have these skills. They studied the unpopular kids enter the group one way. The more popular, well-adjusted kids enter the group a different way. Two cardinal sins that almost always lead to rejection are one, trying to take the lead too soon. And I think this is there too. It was a little hard to read this part of the book, but being out of sync with the frame of reference. So this is exactly what unpopular children tend to do. They push their way into a group, trying to change the subject too abruptly or too soon, offering their own opinions, disagreeing with the others right away, all apparent attempts to draw attention to themselves. How many times did I just disagree with people and correct them? Why are we correcting people? Nobody cares about this little fact they got wrong. All it's doing is just generating ill will and making you stand out and not mesh with the group. I'm talking to myself here. By contrast, the popular children spend time observing the group to understand what's going on before entering in. They just walk in and they don't even say anything at first. They just watch. And then they do something that shows they accept it. They find the rhythm of the group, and then they go with the rhythm of the group. They wait to have their status confirmed before taking initiative and suggesting what the group should do. And so they kind of ease in, and they become part of the group. And then maybe there's a point where they might interject questions or something like that, but you're not going to take the lead before you're sure that you understand what's going on. So application. When entering a social circle, when entering a group, start with observing and active listening. You know, we're not just standing in the group looking around, tapping our foot. That'll stand out. But you're listening, you're watching, you're nodding. You're maybe asking questions. But short little questions. You're not grabbing the wheel and driving it. Try to fit the rhythm of the conversation. I've had to explain to people, there's kind of a rhythm like to these conversations. People are socially awkward. You know, some people who tend to be a little bit on the spectrum as well, they have an especially hard time with this. And, you know, I'm not like a mental health expert. I'm not necessarily addressing more extreme cases like this. But I think for a lot of the cases, a lot of times it's guys that had too much video games and too much porno. And that's really the problem. They need some coaching on how to enter back into relationships. But, you know, you're kind of, if you're going to speak, don't monologue, right? Short little things, short little bursts is how relationships, how conversations work. Ask appropriate questions. You know, some people will come in and they'll ask some super deep, inappropriate question. How's that really sensitive issue in your life going? And you're like, whoa, okay. One, I don't even know you that well, and there's a whole bunch of people here. So what's God been doing in your life lately? They awkwardly ask in the middle of a game where we're all kicking a volleyball around and trying to throw it at each other. Not the time for that. What are three things God's showing you right now? You know, it's like, I kind of want to be like, not right now, dude. Not right now. Is this the time for deep questions? Is it a time for a one-on-one conversation? Part of what happens, people that are uncomfortable, they'll enter a circle and then they'll try to get a one-on-one conversation going with the person right next to them. And you're trying to have this talk, but there's a talk going on right here. And they can't see that that's not good. I've had to sort of be like, is this the time to crack jokes? I had a friend come to me a few months ago and was like, you crack jokes during really serious moments, tense moments, sad moments in these meetings we're having. And I understand it's maybe how you're dealing with it, but you got to see how this comes off. And I'm like, yeah, good point. I meant well. I really wasn't thinking. I wasn't reading the room. It was lack of awareness. Some people, like, I never really thought in this way at all. And I think I'm maybe not the only one. We may need to help people learn how to do this, how to think. A little bit of coaching can go a long way. What they showed that they could meet with the kind of the weird standout kids. And with some coaching, after a year or so of that, you know, they're not the most popular kid in the class, but they're solid middle of the pack. They know how to get along with people. And that's great because then they're in a spot where going forward, they can have relationships. And childhood will not be this painful, lonely time like it was for some of us here, perhaps. A couple other quick points of application. One, remember people's names. Make the effort. It's worth it. Dale Carnegie in his How to Win Friends and Influence People, he says, a person's name is to that person the sweetest and most important sound in any language. I know that it's hard to remember people's names. But God says in Isaiah 43, I have called you by name. He says, I will give you a new name in Revelation 2 that is known only to the one who receives it. No one understands it. It's so personal. And so when you're in a conversation and you get somebody's name, for me, it'll fly right out of my head. Try to use that name as many times as possible when you first meet the person. If it's a real kind of unique name, how do you spell that? Like, write it down, like, after the conversation. Just anything to try to get it into your head. But some of us are like, I don't remember names very well. How much effort on a scale of 1 to 10 do you put into remembering names? 0. Okay, maybe that's why. Like, any effort at all would be better than no effort. But it's so important to people. The other one is smile. I've got a link up there. And I'll put it in the end as well. It's probably a little too small to read, but a couple points about smiling. Smiling has been shown to improve your health. Smiling makes you look more attractive. It makes you look younger. It makes you look more competent and successful. It improves your own mood. Simply activating the smile muscles boosts your mood a little bit. It also is contagious. It's like a yawn. You smile and other people smile. It's a way to serve people. It's a way to serve people. So, you know, what do? Practice till it becomes natural. Some of these things are just practice. You can get in the habit of smiling. You spent your whole life being unhappy and frowning and practicing that. Let's practice something different. You know, you might need to think to yourself, I like this person. Or at least God loves this person. We know that's true. Smile from your eyes. This is not just mouth, but there's a whole face involved in smiling. You might need to call to mind positive memories of this person if you're just not feeling it, but smiling everywhere. Smile at the grocery store. Smile, you know, when you're heading in and out of home church or CT or whatever. Smiling on the phone, they found that people on the other end of the line, they can tell your voice changes slightly when you smile. They can tell you're smiling and they've shown the person on the other end, they can't even see your face, they start smiling. It's pretty remarkable. I was always like, well, I just kind of have a sour face, right? I'm just a frown person. Well, honestly, it helped to learn all the benefits of smiling, just to try a little bit more, you know? We're like, I'm just an unhappy looking person. All right, well, you think Jesus walked around with a sour look on his face all the time? No. Look, you have the joy of the Lord. Show it. You know, think about a person who you know who smiles a lot. Don't you feel happier around that person? Why not try to be that person? Have that same kind of impact on other people. Put some effort into this. You can change. It's a pretty easy one to change, actually. It's a good people skill. All right, there's a million other things I could have said. In summary, though, unlike IQ, relational wisdom is an area where you can grow. You can grow in this area. You can make some real strides. You will need to be intentional and alert. It's not just gonna happen. You're gonna need to try. You're gonna put some effort into this, but this is a skill you can grow in, and improving this is gonna yield so many benefits in your life. So here's some resources. Carnegie's classic, the couple I quoted from Goleman and Bradbury. There's a link to those tests and some blog entries and pamphlets on listening and the Summer Institute sessions from last year. All right, let's pray. Lord, thanks for this. Pray that you'd help us to sift through all this and see what's going to be most helpful. And also, I pray that these would be helpful resources to others moving forward in the months and years ahead. Amen.